Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the 3 years since Russia invaded Ukraine, an estimated 1 million people have been killed or wounded. The war is the most serious conflict in Europe since World War II, and the only thing staving off Russia's total victory is the bravery and determination of the Ukrainian people and their military. Plus, monetary aid and war materiel sent to Ukraine from the U.S. and our NATO allies. But in the United States, the political winds have shifted in ways that would have seemed unimaginable just a few short months ago. We now have a president willing to abandon our allies and the post-World War coalition that has kept us at peace for 75 years. He appears to be siding with a man who has been described as a thug and a murderous dictator, Vladimir Putin. And in something the likes of which we have never seen before, Donald Trump gave a berating tongue-lashing to the president of Ukraine in a live Oval Office confrontation seen around the world. And then Trump cut off all aid and intelligence sharing with Ukraine, leaving them blind and the European Union scrambling to fill the vacuum. That was followed by relentless bombing of Ukraine by Russia over this past weekend. This all seems sudden. But our guest today says that following the collapse of the Soviet Union, six U.S. presidents of both parties began pursuing policies for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia that emboldened Russia. He has written about it in his new book, The Folly of Realism, How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. But the book also contains ideas on how we can reverse that path. It was written by Alexander Vindman, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and former Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration. Vindman's testimony to Congress, of course, outlining the infamous phone call between Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in which Trump asked Zelensky to investigate political rival Joe Biden, helped propel the first of two Trump impeachments. Vindman's testimony brought to the four concerns about the potential misuse of presidential power for personal political gain that persists to this day. Alexander Vindman joins us for the hour. Good morning. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on. Looking forward to the conversation.
You were born in Kyiv when Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. Your family fled when you were 3.5 years old. You became an American citizen, later joined the military, rose through the ranks to become a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, earned a Purple Heart in Iraq. You told the House Impeachment Committee during the first Trump administration that you have, quote, a deep appreciation for American values and ideals and the power of freedom. And that's where I want to start, with American values and ideals. In your opinion, does Donald Trump share those values and ideals?
Yeah, I find myself defending U.S. values and ideals, both with the relationships I have overseas with other foreign policy experts that I've made contact with over the years, or personal relationships, and frankly with youth that are have a hard time embracing American patriotism and American exceptionalism, which I still believe in to this day, and the reason for that is Donald Trump in a lot of ways. The first election of Donald Trump was significant warning signs that there was some deficiencies. Maybe, some people would describe it as rot within our democracy, that we select somebody that is intentionally seeking to harm swaths of the American public, damage our relationships. We had a 4-year reprieve for President Biden. We rebuilt some of those relationships, maybe started demonstrating ourselves as a reliable actor, and then reelected Donald Trump with a much, much more severe rhetoric around who he's going to go after. And now, frankly, implementing policies that are severely damaging our standing around the world, breaking our relationships, breaking the role that the U.S. had in leading stability and security and an environment for democracy to thrive. This is just basically, democracy should be understood at the fundamental level as ensuring people's freedoms. And he's taking the opposite stance overseas and domestically. So I do not think he represents in any way the traditional American values. And I think that's going to be revealed more clearly over the course of these 4 years.
And yet he was embraced by at least half of the people who voted. There were a lot of people who did not vote.
Exactly.
I want to make sure that I understood you, that I heard you correctly, because I thought that I heard you say he is deliberate in eschewing these values and doing things to hurt people that maybe voted for him or didn't vote for him around the country. Do you think that what he's trying to do domestically and what he's doing internationally is deliberately aimed at hurting people, or is it simply a different point of view that has ever been expressed by any president in our lifetimes?
Well, I think maybe those two might be synonymous if you think about it. Presidents are they're public servants that their role is to advance the U.S. security interest and advance U.S. prosperity. This is not an individual that cares about U.S. national security interests or U.S. prosperity. He cares about his own personal status, the ability to win or to garner personal support, and as a demagogue with pleasant sounding slogans, he's more than happy to deliver to even a smaller portion of the population what they're looking for, because that's the only thing that really matters. He's extremely transactional. This is a hard thing to describe because you said it's such a wide departure from anything that we've experienced thus far. I think that's partially true, but there's also an element of score settling and vindictiveness in Donald Trump. There's a desire to snub those that he believes have spurned him in the past. There's a pathology, a strange pathology in which up is down, down is up, and he attempts to recast history. Where he didn't lose the 2020 election, where he wasn't the driver behind an insurrection. There are all sorts of different things that are such a wide departure from anything that we've experienced that I think it's hard to sometimes decipher what the motivations are. But
So
consistently, they're
how do
self-serving.
you explain, given all of that, and we witnessed it with our own eyes, how do you explain the continued acceptance by 50% of the people who voted, not 50% of the electorate, but
Absolutely right.
just a shade over half of the electorate was still
Yeah.
on board? Why?
That's right. I think first of all, that represents about 25% of the population. The other 25% of the population voted Democrat. He won a plurality, not a majority, just by a hair under. And we had enormous more number of Americans that just didn't believe that they had a stake in the democracy, that some 90 million people didn't vote through a combination of apathy and complacency. Apathy because they thought that their vote doesn't matter, that it's irrelevant, and complacency because we tend to be fat, dumb, and happy. We're extremely prosperous society, and people don't think that they need to take a role in the line of democracies on the at stake is doesn't resonate. So I
Let's
think
let.
what you have, yeah, I was just gonna say to answer the question, I think it seems to me that the reason that people voted for him in part was a protest against Biden, this kitchen table issues, costs, the fact that people weren't participating, and a lot of folks were low information voters that didn't jump in until the very end, and at that point the airways were seized with this anti-woke rhetoric, seized on whatever it was with regards to that was being misrepresented as like Democrats, I guess singular focus on trans issues, things that didn't bear out in fact, but played in front of people's eyes in the media landscape. And I think frankly, in a lot of ways, Joe Biden didn't do himself any favors by hanging on too late. He was supposed to be a one-term president. He That's what he seemed to indicate. In a study, he hung on claiming that he was more than capable of running for a second campaign, and maybe he's capable of governing for another 4 years. But he was definitely not running an effective campaign, and then that's a precursor to winning office, serving as president. So I think there was all those different factors in play.
Some people have brushed off Trump's recent encounter with President Zelensky in the Oval Office, which was shocking to most people around the world, as a negotiating tactic. But Trump stressed that Zelensky, quote, doesn't have the cards, which would indicate this is a give and take. This is a quid pro quo. This is some kind of a transaction, that he has no negotiating position and therefore better take the best thing he's offered right now. Do you think that that is a negotiating tactic? Or are these the actions of a wannabe strong man willing to give Putin whatever he wants if there is something in it for him, Donald Trump?
Let's go with that one. I definitely think he's a wannabe strong man, and he's looking to normalize relationships with Russia. But I think he is not a good negotiator. Let's be clear. He wanted to strong arm Zelensky. He wanted to embarrass him and humiliate him, but he still wanted a deal. He didn't realize who he was dealing with. He didn't realize that Zelensky, his primary audience was the folks at home. His next most important audience was demonstrating strength to Putin. Who couldn't be indicated that there was a flexibility or vulnerability. So I think that's a complete misread of the environment, a complete misread of who the Ukrainians were. A population that voted and broke up the Soviet Union, had two revolutions, was going to stand their ground. Trump wanted that deal. He was thinking that he could strong arm this guy, humiliate him, and still get the deal. So that's a poor negotiator. The other thing that we should remember is that he doesn't care. I mean, I've been describing Trump as advanced as displaying maximum malice and maximum ignorance. Maximum malice because they could care less about Ukraine. They're willing to give up Ukraine in its entirety because they don't understand the consequence of that this would just embolden Russia, strengthen Russia to be able to march on, and ignorance of the fact that this is not the way that you bring around peace negotiations. This is the whole theme of the book. It's how the US deceived itself about Russia, or the West deceived itself about Russia and betrayed Ukraine. It's the fact that we've been catering to Russia, accommodating Russia repeatedly, and this is just not simply how you achieve a result with Russia. When you have Russia under pressure, you don't alleviate the pressure on Russia. And when you have Ukraine in the willing to be maximally compromising to try to bring a war to the end, to bring this end. Sorry, I just 2 weeks of travel on the road and still recovering. But yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that this was bad negotiation and misreading the lessons of history.
I have less than a minute left in this segment. So let's, with your book as background, what doesn't Donald Trump understand about Putin? What have American presidents preceding Donald Trump not understood about Putin? And I have less than a minute.
Sure. So I think the fact is that the Russians have consistently banked whatever the West has given. We put Russia first. We've treated Russia as exceptional. We've n missed the fact that Russia breaks its agreements on a regular basis, and that really it only responds to strength. I mean, this is something we should dive into. It's 30 plus 35 years of history, and we've failed to learn the lessons of hopes and fears, succumbing to hopes and fears. That we could do more with Russia, or that if we do too much, that'll break the relationship.
Retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, our guest. His book, the new book, is called The Folly of Realism: How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. We will continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Alexander Vindman, our guest. His new book is called The Folly of Realism: How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. This new approach by Trump is a reversal of 70-plus years of American foreign policy with no real explanation as to why this new approach has any merit. And we're witnessing, as we did in the first Trump administration, day by day, hour by hour, vacillation of policies and policy proposals, both internationally and domestically, aided and abetted by Republicans in Congress. Following the Trump-Zelensky meeting at the White House, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham placed the blame for Trump's outburst on Zelensky. But yesterday, on Fox News Sunday, Graham warned of potentially disastrous consequences for Ukraine if the Trump administration does not restart military aid and intelligence sharing, adding, quote, "As long as the fighting is going on, if we pull the plug on Ukraine, it would be worse than Afghanistan," something about which Republicans have been very critical. He said he believes we should continue with military aid and intelligence sharing until there is a ceasefire. And as far as Russia goes, he says, this is Lindsey Graham talking, he says that he is planning to introduce sanctions on their banking and energy sectors next week to get them to the negotiating table. And if they don't engage in ceasefire and peace talks, quote, "we should sanction the hell out of them." I don't know how many more sanctions we can put on them. We've been putting on sanctions on them for a couple of years. But nonetheless, we're getting mixed signals coming from Washington. What do you think of Senator Graham's approach?
Well, I think, first of all, Senator Graham might need a veto-proof majority vote for this, because it's quite possible that Donald Trump would veto bipartisan legislation that would heavily sanction Russia. And we can do a lot more with sanctions. We could do full blocking sanctions, which would mean that it's not just us, but anybody else that does business with Russia could be subject to secondary sanctions, which means that we could potentially chalk off Russia's access to money to fund this war. I think that's a viable approach. Will it have some consequences? Yes, it's going to have a consequence in terms of oil and gas access to the Europeans and prices around the world. But it would be a major lever to put maximum pressure on Russia. Lindsey Graham, Lindsey Graham might as well have been like a case officer, because his swings in the way he communicates are, at one time to appease Donald Trump and to show him that he's on sides, he's a friendly a voice, and the other side, he's basically talking to him in the language of Afghanistan and how embarrassing that was for the Biden administration to try to kind of get him to warn him off from pursuing this policy of blocking aid to Ukraine and intelligence. I would say that, the problem with the Republicans, both in the cabinet and in the Congress, is that they flatter Donald Trump as if he is a strong man. They do not offer anything in the way of criticism, good counsel. It doesn't have to be even open criticism, just good counsel to try to get the president on sides. Maybe they do this behind the scenes to a certain extent. They certainly won't do it publicly.
Well, doesn't that then make him a strong man? I mean, if everybody's capitulating, isn't he what he thinks he is?
Well, I mean, if I feel comfortable calling him a clown when he says that he's going to arrest protesters on college campuses, right or wrong, it's an infringement on First Amendment rights. That doesn't look like a particularly good strongman if you can't, silence all opponents. But yes, too many folks within the Republican establishment do feel cowed. They are scared of what that means for them with their political careers, with regards to their ability to win re-election. And Elon Musk is the second, part of that. It's a double-edged sword, because Elon Musk's war chest to fund somebody to primary, that is a 1-2 punch that, intimidates just about all Republicans and prevents them from being the least bit critical, even when it means they have to give up, forsake U.S. national security and the relationships that we build and the stability of the world.
So let's get back to Ukraine, because there are a lot of Americans, after so many years of our being involved in conflicts around the globe, would like us to stop being the world's policeman. So talk about and that's probably where a lot of people come down on the side of Donald Trump. They don't necessarily see the transactional side of what he's trying to do over there, or sidling up to Putin. They see it as a way of getting America out of foreign conflicts about which we know nothing and have achieved not a lot, in their opinions. So talk about the strategic importance of Ukraine and our involvement in funding their war effort. As a former member of the National Security Council, as someone widely regarded as a preeminent national security strategist on Russia and Ukraine, what's at stake for the average American?
Yep. So this is a good, this is an awesome opportunity to try to do a quick synopsis of the book. You know, this I look at 35 years of history between Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S., and it is shocking how important a role this country, by the way, the largest in Europe, at one point it had a population of 50 million, how large it's played a role in U.S. national security. Ukraine was the root cause of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Just months before the collapse of the Soviet Union, George H.W. Bush traveled to Ukraine and counseled the Ukrainians to not race towards independence, not race towards their own state that they've been struggling for decades, or in some cases, centuries. And the Ukrainians dismissed that. They were going to fight for what they thought they what they knew they wanted, was which was their own separate, distinct country. That brought about the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union could not exist without Ukraine. The president at the time, Yeltsin, said so, and dissolved the Soviet Union on that basis. Just years late, or almost immediately afterwards, Ukraine inherited 4,500 nuclear weapons. We were highly engaged to make sure that the Ukrainians give up their nuclear weapons. We provided security assurances and some financial support to help them transition from a communist economy to a market economy and capitalism and become a democracy. We took our eye off the ball because after they gave up their nuclear weapons, we shifted entirely to our focus on Russia and the things that we could do with Russia, this idea of hopes and fears, hopes that we could do more with the Russians, hopes that we could bring them into be a democracy, and fears that if we held the line, if we were conditional in our support, that somehow that was going to break the relationship. Constantly accommodating Russia over the course of the 30 plus years. The Orange Revolution, a critical moment in which the Ukrainians pivoted hard towards the West. We decided that we were not going to be entirely supportive of Ukraine because that would provoke Russia. We at one point decided that, you know, it was important for Europe to expand NATO because the European nations demanded it, even saying in some regards that they were going to go develop their own nuclear arsenals to defend themselves against the potential reemergence of Russian power. We still decided that we were going to put our eggs on Russia through Russia's graduation from just mischief making to hybrid warfare, interference elections, to military force. Throughout this whole time, Ukraine continued to capture our attention, even if we were disinterested, maybe even if we were still focused on Russia, Russia first. And then 2014, 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, this large-scale war started. It started in a significant manner. It wasn't the full-scale war that we saw in 2022, including 4 years of that being under Trump administration, which he didn't resolve anything. He didn't choose to put enough pressure on Russia or support Ukraine sufficiently. He played a major role in the full-scale war emerging just, you know, on the back end of his administration. So Ukraine is critical for a couple of different reasons. One is it's a block on further Russian aggression. It's not in NATO, but it's right on the edge. And if Russia is successful in attacking and seizing Ukraine, it builds the massive power, this enormous power to keep build Russia, keep empire building. It's also important from a food supply standpoint. Think about the food shortages that occurred when there was a block on trade out of on grain out of Ukraine. It's a breadbasket, not just for Europe, but for the world. It's a source of important rare earths that we need for our economy if Trump didn't blow that deal. There are many, many different reasons why it's important for us to continue to support Ukraine, not the least of which is that we want to make sure that Russia is not strong enough to continue to advance.
Help me understand something. You mentioned that the former Soviet leader, Boris Yeltsin, said there can be no Soviet Union without Ukraine, which echoes what Zbigniew Brzezinski, the former national security advisor under President Carter, said. He said it cannot be stressed enough that without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be an empire. But with Ukraine suborned and then subordinated, Russia automatically becomes an empire. That obviously is why, obviously Putin believes that, which is why he wants to get it back. But explain to me why Ukraine is so important to Russia.
It's critically important to Russia because it is the core of Russian identity. These their interaction between yeah the interaction between these countries it goes back 1,000 years. At the beginning of that story, it was Kiev. It was the predecessor of Ukraine that was the most important power in the region. It dominated the region. Somewhere along the way, after we could go back to the Mongol hordes, that they sacked the city of Kiev. It provided an opportunity for the predecessor to Russia to start to thrive. When Russia became big enough, it started to expand in each direction. And part of the story of Russia was to recapture its greatness, was to take control of Ukraine. And Ukraine, in a moment of weakness, made a kind of a deal, a temporary deal for Russian support as it was fending off other empires, the Ottoman Empire, the Muslims. And the Polish-Lithuanian Empire, which was Catholic, it sided with these the Eastern Orthodox. The Russia took that as license to be able to control and dominate Ukraine. And for the course of the next 300 years, it slowly started to absorb Ukraine and try to dominate it, suppress the language, suppress the cultural identity. For Russia, Russia is not whole unless it's Great Russia, which is the Russian Federation, Little Russia, which is what they refer to Ukraine, and Belarus, White Russians. It needs all those things to be complete.
So Russia needs them. They see them as a piece of Russia, without which they cease to be the important empire that they view themselves as. But what about the Ukrainians? They speak Russian. Many of them have family members who live in Russia. They share the same alphabet. They share that Eastern Orthodox religion, many of them. Why is it so important for Ukrainians not to be part of Russia, to be their own separate nation operating under different principles? Why?
Sure. So there is or some overlap because they're both Slavic nations and have Eastern Orthodox roots. But Ukraine has had maintained its own identity. I mean, like if you understand the region, there's this whole Cossack, like deep independent-minded root to Ukrainian identity. These were like horse warriors that kind of dominated that portion of the world. Actually, the horse or the Cossack warriors were instrumental as Russia took control of Ukraine to Russia's own expansion. It used this particular cohort to expand to all the way across Siberia, all the way to the Pacific Ocean. But these were a distinct group of people. Ukraine has its own language. The alphabets are similar, but the language is very, very distinct. Ukrainians could understand Russian, but the Russians can't really understand Ukrainian. They have their own, historical leadership. And Ukraine, the fact is that Ukraine has been an independent state for the past 35 years, with Russian diminishing in importance, Ukrainian increasing in importance, a deeper understanding of the cultural figures, the literary figures, the historical figures that were responsible for the development of the Ukrainian identity. Russia is living in the past. It's living in the period of Russian Empire or Soviet Union, where it brought together these 15 different republics under its control. Russia doesn't have the power, frankly, to have that kind of empire. Simply put, if you think about what they've managed to achieve over the past 3 years, they didn't win the war in 3 days. They haven't won the war in 3 years, and they're not going to, even with the U.S. absence, they're not going to win anytime soon. The U.S. current approach delays the solution to this current problem.
So even if you don't understand the history of these two countries, even if you don't understand the history of our relationship with these two countries, even if you neglect to remember that we were among the powers that coaxed Ukraine to give up their Soviet era nuclear weapons with the guarantee that we would be there to protect them from aggression, and now we seem to be turning our backs on that. Given the weakness of Russia that we've all witnessed, I mean, the 3-day war is 3 years in, and they're bringing in troops from North Korea, and they're still suffering major casualties. And we, as you have said, have helped Ukraine, but always a day late and a dollar short over the last several years. Why would Donald Trump want to change the policy of helping this fledgling democracy? How do you explain his wanting to help Putin?
It doesn't make a lot of sense, except if you believe, if you understand that Trump and Putin have, frankly, a fairly similar worldview. Putin believes in this concept of derzhavnost, great powers. And in his view, there's only China, Russia, and the US, and everybody else is beholden to those countries. If and Trump seems to be on board with that kind of idea, where he could coerce small and medium states. It doesn't make a difference if they're our closest friends, our most important trading partners. He is willing to cast that aside and be coercive with our friends and allies that will not be there for us in the future when we are subject to attack. And he's willing to cozy up. He's willing to flatter and accommodate strong powers. That's this. That is a similar view to Putin himself. I think this is particularly dangerous because it exactly does upset this worldview that the U.S. And the policy the U.S. has had since the end of World War II, where we believe in democracies coming together, working together for mutual prosperity.
So Donald Trump promised retribution if reelected. He promised it over and over on the campaign trail. Is this decision of cutting off funding to the Ukrainian war effort, his quid pro quo move that would have forced Russia, Ukraine to give up 50% of their mineral rights to the United States for our past assistance, is it just payback for that call that you were in on with Zelensky where he asked him to find dirt on Joe Biden and he didn't? Is that what this is all about when it comes right down to the bottom line?
That's part of it. I think it's a strong power versus weaker power perspective. He misses how important small and medium powers are to the globe. You just have to look at Afghanistan. We didn't have our way with Afghanistan after 20 years. These states have a lot of a say in what their futures are. I think that's part of it. I think the retribution part of it is absolutely critical. Also, he wants to normalize relationships. He wants to have a friendly relationship with this, somebody he admires, a potential fellow strongman, and he could damn Ukraine also. This is all part of the story of why he cut him off, and it's something that I predicted in my when he was elected.
And yet, you also say that Donald Trump is simply following a similar path to six other U.S. presidents when it comes to our relationship with Russia and with Ukraine, and we'll talk about that when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is retired Lieutenant Colonel in the U.S. Army, Alexander Vindman, former Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council, and the author of a new book called The Folly of Realism, How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. Before we talk about that and the past presidents who have followed a similar, but although different, but a similar path toward Russia and Ukraine, let me talk just one more time about you. During the Trump administration, he fired you the first time around. He had you removed from the White House. There are those on the right who might quickly dismiss anything you have to say about him or about his policies toward Ukraine because you have an axe to grind. Do you have a ready answer for that?
Sure. So I would say that I served for 22 years in the military. Served in combat, served in Kiev. I served in Moscow for 3 years, served in the Pentagon. I authored the strategy for Russia, for the Pentagon, before any of this political chicanery unfolded that drew me into the public eye. My concern, I have no love for Trump. And certainly he's brought my family into the crosshairs. But my biggest axe to grind, and it's sharp, on both sides, is the fact that he's consistently harmed U.S. national security interests. He's consistently harmed our standing. He is burning our bridges with our closest allies and cozying up to our adversaries. He's making us weaker. And, you know, to me, that episode just, a week and change ago on Friday was a demonstration of some of the worst aspects of his nature. And the American public is seeing it. You know, I saw a poll that just came out a couple of days ago. 67% of Americans, Republicans and Democrats, want to continue to support Ukraine.
So given this approach and the fact that he had the United States delegation to the United Nations side recently with Russia and North Korea and Belarus in opposing a resolution condemning Russia for invading Ukraine, you still say that he is trotting somewhat the same path that six previous presidents have trod over the years. So tell me how that's possible, given this departure and approach.
The subtitle is self-explanatory, right? How the West deceived itself about Russia and betrayed Ukraine. The title requires a tiny bit of explanation. Realism is an international relations theory. It's this idea that countries maximally pursue their interests. Values are irrelevant. And because of this, you breed a very transactional approach. You want to win in each engagement, each negotiation. Trump is just the ultimate the death cult stage of realism, where we're about to drink the Kool-Aid. Exceptionally transactional, doesn't even learn the lessons of his own first administration. He doesn't understand the way that you engage with Russia. But the line has always been Russia first. It's been putting that relationship with a nuclear power, that largest country in the world, a massive conventional military, that we didn't want to. We want to do some things positively with them, like arms control. We wanted to prevent the relationship from devolving a cold war. So we always put that relationship first. We bought down risk in the short term, but we emboldened Russia. Trump is just the ultimate stage of this wild swing to support Russia consistently. That's the consistency only in that the trend line is in the arrow points in one direction, but he is by far the worst practitioner of realism.
And the fundamental problem of the last six presidencies that you say they've all made mistakes in dealing with Russia is the fact that it starts with a U.S. policy that is Russia-centric. You say Russia's vision of itself as the exceptionally and naturally dominant player in the Soviet space. We've played right into that. If Russia is not the dominant player, is there one? Or are there other states of the former Soviet Union, that had we focused our attention on them, we'd be in a different situation today?
So I am thoughtful because some of these folks are my colleagues. I interviewed the presidents involved in this decision making, and they were not trying to harm U.S. national security. Bill Clinton, Al Gore, they were focused on trying to bring both Russia and Ukraine into the democratic community of nations and transform into market economies and capitalism. But at somewhere along the way, they should have realized, even if Russia was the biggest player in the region, that if Russia is actually not going to be a willing partner, if they were going to be a spoiler, if they were going to rebuild empire, that we should probably not put all our resources into just appeasing or working with Russia, that we also needed, our obligation was to security in Europe, which is the ultimate goal, making sure that our most important security relationship, most important economic relationship is sound. And somewhere along the way, certainly by the time you get to the Orange Revolution, you start to think about, well, we should have invested in Ukraine, hardening Ukraine and making sure Ukraine had a stable economy and industrial base, that we provided them weapons. By the time the war started in 2014, President Obama shouldn't have been frightened by Russia saber rattling. Instead, should have made some re investments in Ukraine to harden Ukraine to prevent even a full-scale war from unfolding. But both administrations, Democratic and Republican, along the way, put everything into Russia and failed to miss the warning signs about Russia going in the wrong direction or harden Ukraine. That's the criticism.
Experts have warned that if we do not contain Russia in Ukraine, the seizing of Ukraine will be just the start of an ongoing takeover of that part of the world, as Putin eyes other former members of the Soviet bloc, and that if we're not careful, especially when it comes to allowing Ukraine to join NATO, this could become World War III. In the Oval Office, Trump wagged his finger at Zelensky and said three times, "You're gambling with World War III." You say the Russia-Ukraine war can already be considered a world war. And you say that because you point out the authoritarian world is watching. Talk about that.
So I think it's, first of all, from a, you know, if you look at the land masses involved, Russia is by far the largest country in the world. Ukraine is the largest country in Europe. That's a large portion of land that's already at war. But in the military sphere, it hasn't spilled over. In the economic sphere, in the political sphere, in the informational sphere, we're already waging war against Russia, or Russia's waging war against us. Same thing with China. The only thing that hasn't completely spilled over yet is the military sphere. And I think that's exactly right. If you have Russia successful in Ukraine, if you have Russia dictating terms in Ukraine, it will rebuild its military power. That might only take 2 or 3 years, and then it's back on the march, rebuilding its military might. And it's not just about Russia. The Chinese are also have a longstanding one China policy. They want Taiwan back. The Chinese also take this a lesson from this and are on the march.
So if Putin and Russia are already at war with the West, if China is watching, could the motivation that Donald Trump has for sidling up to dictators be that he wants to be friendly with and on the side with people who are at war with us to stop that war from expanding, or be on the right side of history when it does take over?
Yeah, I think that would be a very, I mean, that would be Trump being extremely juvenile in understanding world affairs and how to manage these kinds of crises. It is not by accommodating strongmen and these authoritarian regimes that you get them to not be aggressive, right? That's exactly the opposite. The lesson of the past 30 years is that by sidling up to the Russians, we embolden them. They took a bite and kept taking more. We are a massive power, but the way we falter is by chipping away at our relationships around the world, our standing, our alliances, and then we're isolated when we do start to face really, really serious threats from the Chinese and the Russians. There is no separating those two. They're coming for us. The question is, do we have a team when we face them down, or are we by ourselves? And Trump is setting us up to be able to fight by ourselves. That is a disaster. We will be isolated economically, weaker economically, and we won't not have that very powerful alliance from the Europeans. That is a 20 trillion euro economy that we would have on our sides. If we and the only time the Article 5 from NATO has been invoked is when the US attacked. I don't understand this basic notion of isolating ourselves and leaving ourselves exposed when the wolves come after us.
Article 5 is the NATO mandate that any NATO nation attacked will be supported by all other members of NATO. And the only time it has been invoked was following 9/11 in support of the United States. Militarily speaking, if this war has been waged now for 3 years, and Putin has not only not been able to take major pieces of territory and not win the war, his casualties are immense in terms of injuries and loss of life, and he's bringing in North Korean soldiers, and he's depleting his own treasury. I'm just wondering, if they can't win that war in 3 years, how dangerous are they in reality? How could they possibly expect to take most of Eastern Europe?
Sure. So I'd say a couple of things here. First of all, that the big new Brzezinski line is absolutely essential. That with Ukraine suborned and subordinated, they take another 40 million people. They have Ukraine's industrial base. They basically take a already extremely battle-hardened Russian military, not particularly effective against Ukraine, that's also battle-hardened. But you combine those two and against the untested European military, but which has an enormous latent potential, enormous industrial base, it starts to look a little bit different, especially if you're talking about a world in which NATO doesn't exist, in which basically there's a fracture between maybe even Western and Eastern Europe, and you could pick off countries one at a time, the small Baltic states or Poland or something of that nature. There is a world in which Russia, with Ukraine, is able to snap up small portions of it, you know, eating the elephant one bite at a time. That's the danger. And it doesn't necessarily have to happen in, year or two, 1 or year 2. It's year 3, year 4, year 5. And your Eastern Europeans are very, very acutely aware and sensitive to this.
To many, it is becoming increasingly apparent that Donald Trump does not like democracy. He wants to be an authoritarian strongman. That is, that's everything he's done so far, to many people, indicate that's the road he wants to be on. And you have said something I don't believe I've heard anybody else say, that a prosperous Ukraine makes an illiberal, undemocratic, and authoritarian Russia unviable in the long term. So does, certainly Putin recognizes that. Does Donald Trump, is that part of the motivation here?
I think he probably doesn't understand or care enough about that aspect. I think for him, it's much more base considerations. My fellow strongman, my buddy, the person I want to sidle up to. Maybe I want to reduce some of the risks on the short term, but that's again he's highly transactional. He doesn't understand the lessons of the past, and that by constantly appeasing Russia, by bending the knee to Russia, that you encourage them. So I think yes, of course, from a strategic standpoint, Ukraine being successful, Ukraine being prosperous, which is why the Russians went to war in 2014, and when they failed to get Ukraine to be a failed state, went to full scale war in 2022. Time was taken away. They had to act sooner rather than later. That's why they went to war and thinking that Ukraine would be too strong eventually. They didn't know how right they were, frankly. But I think those are real considerations. For Trump, it's far more basic. Strongmen good, democracy is bad. Doesn't care about our alliances. It's a very, very dangerous world where the U.S. is not only unreliable and unpredictable, but is a bad actor.
You say that the next administration, excuse me, will inherit a fractured global order and allies wary of America's reliability, and we seem to be moving toward our own version of authoritarian oligarchy in this country. But let me end on a positive note. Although that you have said that things under Trump are not going to get better than what we've been experiencing, that they will only get worse. As an experienced analyst, you believe that Trump and Republican overreach might result in big changes that were impossible prior to Trump taking office. Things like immigration reform that has been unable to take place because of our bifurcated Congress, things like a move toward more universal health care. Given the GOP controls all three branches of government, or more accurately, Donald Trump controls at least two branches, possibly three. There are no guarantees that Trump will ultimately follow the law or even court decisions that prevent him from doing some of the things that he wants to do. Why do you believe that in 2 or 4 years that power might be diminished and that there's a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, mainly because I understand the kind of damage he's going to cause to us domestically and abroad. And I understand that it's going to need a massive overhaul and a massive correction. Eliminating basic social safety nets, attacking Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, doing the most harm to the least capable to suffer that harm is going to wake people up. We're going to be in a period where people can't be asleep at the wheel 4 years from now. And I think that's an opportunity for a massive change, a true mandate, and thus for a correction from the extremes that we're facing now into something that actually serves the American good better.
I have about 30 seconds left. Can Ukraine prevail in this war without the intelligence provided by the United States, without the materiel provided by the United States? Can they prevail?
It's American hubris and chauvinism to think that without us, the Ukrainians fail. They will persevere. It'll be harder. They're going to suffer what they did last week, but Ukraine doesn't disappear, and the Europeans have an opportunity to play a critical role. So Trump doesn't hold all the cards. He doesn't have the Trump card. He's mistaken.
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, former Director of European Affairs for the National Security Council. His new book is called The Folly of Realism: How the West Deceived Itself About Russia and Betrayed Ukraine. Thank you very much for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.